Before we get started, any questions you guys have? What is the last one on the board behind me? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. I'll move out of the way, but I'm going to actually talk about it in uno momento. That's right, I'm bilingual. Not really. Any other questions? All right, we are in Matthew chapter 17. We finished Matthew chapter 16 with the great confession and then the great failure of Peter. And Jesus, for the very first time, clearly articulates what his political program is going to culminate in, and that is his death and resurrection. Today, we're moving into the Transfiguration, and what you see on the board, there's really nowhere for me to run to get out of your guys' way on this. What you see on the board is something I'm kind of toying with. I think that Matthew chapter 17 summarizes the entire book of Matthew so far. It's not as tight as I want it to be, but it is what it is. Why would Matthew chapter 17 be a good place for a summary point, first of all?
It's right after the second shift.
Right after the second shift. Right after we start heading, as Jeremy said this morning, beelining towards the cross, towards Jerusalem. We're moving in that direction. And as a result, it would make sense if this was a summary section. Here's kind of my thought process behind this. Matthew chapters 1 and through 3, we have this Exodus motif that's really hammering on the Moses parallels. And ultimately, we see the emergence of Elijah. And what we have in chapter 17, 1 through 4, is the emergence of Moses and Elijah, which we'll see in a bit in the Transfiguration. Matthew chapter 3, 13 through 17, we have a direct linguistic parallel in Matthew 17, 5, with the voice from heaven. What is Matthew 3, 13 through 17? Huh? It is Jesus, but what about him?
Baptist.
The baptism of Jesus. Whenever he's baptized and the voice from heaven comes. We have word for word the exact same thing, and he just adds a couple of, he adds listen to him. That's what he adds in 17:5. Matthew chapters 5 through 7, where we have basically a discussion of the fulfillment of the law. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, they didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And Matthew chapter 17, verse 8, I'm going to argue today, is symbolically showing Jesus' fulfillment of the law and the prophets. Matthew chapter 8 through 10, we have the revelation of Jesus' identity, which is validated by his works. And yet, every time he does these works, he tells them, don't tell anyone. And we have the same thing that happens in chapter 17, verse 8. These amazing works that have just happened that validate Jesus' identity, and yet he says, shut up, don't tell anybody. Matthew chapter 11. Then we have the whole John the Baptist issue. Is this really the one to come? And after Jesus says, well, John got it wrong, he is still the Elijah that is to come. And that is the conversation that occurs right after the Transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17, 10 through 13. Following Matthew chapter 11 is the Beelzebub controversy, where a demon-possessed person becomes prime, front and center regarding the identity of Jesus. And that's exactly what we find in Matthew 17, 14 through 18, where they bring to him someone that is demon-possessed, and it ultimately deals with the identity of his kingdom and the identity of Jesus and the lack of faith that his disciples show because, they can't exorcise him. Matthew chapter 13. We have the discussion of the nature and the program of the kingdom, the victory in the face of conflict. And we have one of those parables is explicitly referenced here in Matthew 17, 19 through 21, when he says, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you can look at this mountain and tell it to go into the sea, or to move over here, and it will. So the mustard seed language once again surfaces. And then Matthew chapter 14 through 16, which is displaying this victory, conflict that was described in 13 is what we see that concludes today, where Jesus once again for the second time in Matthew clearly articulates his suffering and then a subsequent resurrection. You see how I'm conceptually framing this? I'm arguing, and what's interesting about it is that all these parallels, they come in the order that we would expect. I mean, it almost is like he's marching us all the way through the first 16 chapters, landing at chapter 17 so that we're really primed and ready to make our way to the road to Jerusalem. So you can disagree with that. That's fine. It's still a work in progress. But if you want to add to that at some other point, go ahead. I'd be interested to see what you got. Okay. Any questions about that? Did that make any sense at all, or is that just me rambling? Okay. Because I do that from time to time. My wife has to rebuke me. But All right, chapter 17, verse 1. After 6 days, okay, wait a minute, really quick. What's weird about that? What? Why is that weird?
We rarely hear other numbers.
Yeah, other than what? So what could possibly be happening here? Because at this point, you're cluing in on something I agree on. And that is, at this point, we've literally had no numbers in Matthew that have been just an actual measure number. They've all been weighted. And if that is true, from that hermeneutical lens, I should assume that this probably has some symbolic significance. Does it have to? No. It could be a point where we just say, hey, this one just says 6 days, and that's just all it's saying. But if I'm moving along this trajectory in Matthew, whenever I come to a number, I should assume symbolic unless it forces me otherwise because of the way he's laid out his numbers so far. Right? Remember, even the 14 generations three times had some sort of symbolic parallel to Dawid, the name of David in Hebrew. He doesn't just count things on accident. So what would 6 possibly be a reference towards?
It's incomplete, and this is the 7th day, and so the transfiguration will happen on the 7th day. And so there's a fulfillment and a completion.
Yeah, that's possible. And I'm wrestling with, and I like that. Where you're headed with that. I agree with the whole 6 is emphasizing incompleteness. Although if he was trying to point to the 7th day, I wonder why he doesn't just say on the 7th day. For me, it seems like he specifically grabs the number 6 to emphasize incompleteness, not completeness. I will say this, there is, and I'll give you to my symbolic interpretation in a minute, but there is an Exodus parallel as well to this. Do you remember? You read it a long time ago. You've read hundreds of pages since then. You remember by any chance? It's a little more obscure, but it's in there. Anybody want to take a guess? Before Moses receives the law on Sinai, he is in 6 days of preparation. 6 days of preparation. And then he receives this amazing revelation from God, the law. 6 days, and then we receive an amazing revelation from God. I think that's a pretty strong Jewish referent. I will say this, though, about the incompleteness that Hutch brought up. A lot of the Jews would look at what's about to happen in the Transfiguration and say, this is the moment we've been waiting for. Wouldn't they? I mean, my word. Key Old Testament figures, alive from the dead, appear with the presence of God, enveloped in a cloud, a voice from heaven, and the glowing, majestic Messiah's on the scene. And they're thinking, yeah, that's right, we're ready for Jerusalem now. Right? They're thinking, oh, buddy, this is the event. This is the moment. This is where we've been headed. And I think the number 6 possibly would say, now listen, this is a significant event, but this is not the event. The event was just talked about moments ago, and it has to do with the cross and a resurrection. The event is going to be brought up once again at the very end of this transfiguration situation, whenever Jesus says, I'm going to be going to Jerusalem, be betrayed into the hands of the Jewish elite, killed, and raised 3 days from them. That is the event. Transfiguration is a significant event. It's pretty stinking cool. But it is not the totality. It is not the complete event. It is not where the kingdom is established. I think 6 may carry some weight in that. Or it could just be 6 days and I'm just making up junk. Either way, let's move on. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. That's almost like taunting James, isn't it? Like, Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. But, you know, James is totally left out. And led them up a high mountain by themselves. What are those three usually referred to as? What's that? The inner circle. The inner three. Three-fourths of the four disciples that were chosen at the beginning. Now, some people, and this is, I'm moving in the realm of speculation, and that's always kind of fun if you do it sometimes. Then again, there's entire theological doctrines built off speculation, but that's not always so fun. This one, though, the inner circle, I want to ask the question, why did Jesus choose these three? to come to such significant events. Some people will say, and this is possible, that these three were just kind of the cream of the crop. They're the ones that just stood out from everybody, and Jesus is like, dude, these are the ones I'm going to invest most of my time in. I tend to not agree with that. I tend to think it's the exact opposite. That these are the kind of the three rejects of the group that just don't really get it. And Jesus is like, dude, if these guys are going to do anything good, I'm going to have to spend extra time with them. They need more one-on-one treatment. I mean, think about these three for a minute, especially two of them. What about Peter? Is he cream of the crop? He does it. I mean, he'll say awesome stuff, and then the very next moment, he says the dumbest things you could possibly say. He says, you're the Christ. Jesus is like, yes. And he's like, but let me rebuke you, Lord. Like, you're going to do what? You're going to rebuke Jesus. You know, in just a couple of chapters, or next chapter actually, Peter will say it now. How many times am I supposed to forgive somebody? I mean, isn't there a limit on this whole deal? Oh, Jesus, no matter where you go, I will always follow you, even to death. Really, Peter? Really? Because in just a little bit, you're going to be faced with a little girl and you're going to deny me because she frightens you. Cream of the crop? I don't know. Or James and John. John, this is the other one. John is my favorite person in the Bible outside of Jesus. I love him. But man, he was an arrogant bigot before Jesus got a hold of him. That's just the truth. I mean, in just a little bit, in the next chapter, we're going to see his arrogance. Whenever he asks his mommy to go and ask Jesus for one of the chief seats in the kingdom. Hey, I want to sit up there. And the other ten are going, they're up in arms going, sons of thunder, why are you wanting to get the one of the right and the left hand? You arrogant punks. My word, is he a bigot? Whenever he comes across the Samaritans, what does he ask Jesus? Do you want us to call fire down on these people? I mean, they're Samaritans. Are they really worth anything? I'm not so sure these inner three are the cream of the crop. I'm thinking they needed a little bit of help. And some people would think, well, what about Judas? Yeah, I don't think Judas... Well, we'll get to that at a different day. Bottom line is, that's my theory. But again, you don't have to agree with it. That's fine. I really don't have much proof outside of what I just said. So, verse 2, although I will say this. There is a ministry principle in that as well. Is that a lot of the times in ministry, it's very easy for us just to grab the people that are already transformed and invest in them some, and think, look what I did. But man, you know what? It'd probably make your body a whole lot stronger if you grabbed the people on the bottom rung of the ladder and helped them move up five steps. You know, kind of the first will be last, last will be first type of thing. Verse 2. There he was transfigured. Let me say this real quick, though. A lot of times those people are the ones you really get annoyed hanging out with a lot, though. They're high maintenance. They cause a lot of problems. They can be very annoying. And Jesus says, yeah, I got Peter, James, and John. What do you got? Okay. There he was transfigured before them. I almost interrupted myself again, but I'm not going to. Okay. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Now, if Jesus turns into a light bright in front of your eyes, that's probably something that would stick in your mind for quite a while. You know what I mean? Especially Peter, Andrew, and John. And it's significant the fact that, Andrew doesn't write any of the rest of our New Testament documents. But I believe that Peter and John both bring back up or refer back to this event in their writings. Peter, in two places. Mark chapter 9, 2 through 13, the Gospel of Mark, records the transfiguration. And church history tells us that Mark wrote his gospel based on the preachings of Peter. So I think that that's one of the traditions that Peter was handing down to Mark to be recorded. Second place is in 2 Peter chapter 1, 17 through 18. I do at this point hold that 2 Peter was written by Peter. And that's not because I'm just a conservative fundy, But it's because the arguments about it, I just don't think are that compelling. Is it much, much different Greek than 1 Peter? Absolutely. But the fact of the matter is that the functional use of amanuensis throughout the ancient times, with the also liberty to form things in a more eloquent manner, and it still be just as significantly from the author themselves, leads me to think that that could be a possibility of what's happening in 2 Peter. I don't see a conflict in theology in 2 Peter. I see it as complementing 1 Peter. But whatever. Yes, Brandolin. Mark chapter 9, 2 through 13. And then this next one, 2 Peter 1, 17 through 18. And I'll read this to you. Peter says, "For we received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory, saying, 'This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased.' We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." Clearly talking about the transfiguration. Clearly. John, though, is a little bit of a different beast when it comes to this. Because the Gospel of John does not have the transfiguration. I know. It's kind of weird, isn't it? You'd think that John would be like, "I got some first-hand witness to this and it's sweet." However, I think John, writing 30 to 20, anywhere from 20 to 30 years after the other Gospels, says, okay, they got the transfiguration of their Gospels. My Gospel, I'll focus on other things. But I do think he refers to the idea of the transfiguration in Revelation chapter 1. I think his linguistic parallels, his conceptual parallels, is the way that he describes Jesus on the island of Patmos suggests that he experienced the same thing twice, seeing the glorified Christ while on earth. Let me describe some of those parallels. Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. He is isolated on the island of Patmos. Once again in Matthew 17, 1. They go up on the high mountain by themselves. Revelation 1, 13. The clothing of Jesus is described as these glowing terms. They're brilliant. They're radiant. Matthew 17, 16. Jesus' clothes are once again as white as the light. Revelation 1, 13. He describes Jesus as one like the Son of Man. That is the moniker that's used in Matthew 17, 9 to describe Jesus as well. Revelation 1, 16 says, "His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance." And Matthew 17, 2, it says, "His face shone like the sun." Revelation 1, 17, the reaction to the appearance of Jesus is they fall as though dead. John falls as though dead in Revelation 1, 17. Matthew 17, 6, we see a similar thing, where they are terrified and they fall face down to the ground. Revelation 1:17, Jesus responds by touching John. Matthew 17:6, Jesus comes and touches them. 1:17, Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." Matthew 17:7, once again, Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." There is a key difference, though, in what John experiences in Matthew 17 on the Mount Transfiguration and Revelation 1. For in Matthew 17:9, Jesus says, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the resurrection happens. But in Revelation 1:19, this holy event follows of Jesus looking at John and saying, "Write down everything you see." Why? He's resurrected at this point in John's life when he's on the island of Patmos. So I think John experienced it twice. I do think he's reflecting upon the transfiguration in his description of Jesus on the island of Patmos. It's theory day, because you can disagree with that too. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. You cannot overstate the significance of Moses and Elijah in the Jewish mind. What is their significance? This will be an awesome test essay-like question. What is their significance? What? Yes, Law and the Prophets. Who is what? Moses is the key representative of the law. And Elijah came to be known as kind of the key representative of the prophets. Now, what is significant about those two symbolic references, the law and the prophets? What is significant? Say it again. Jesus fulfills them, exactly. What else, though?
It's kind of what defines the Jewish kingdom.
Yes. Elaborate, yes.
Like their law was in a lot of ways different than all the other laws of other kingdoms because it was given from God directly.
Yeah.
And then the prophets was God speaking directly to them and guiding them.
Yeah.
So it's this whole, it's all revelation from God.
In fact, you're exactly right. In fact, the way in which that you could refer to the whole Old Testament was by simply saying the law and the prophets. Right? The law and the prophets. The law. I did not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, Jesus says, like Caleb pointed out. The law and the prophets was a shorthand way of referring to the whole Old Testament. And now, at the Mount of Transfiguration, we have the law and the prophets. And they're standing with Jesus. And in a moment, that's going to say something quite significant. Because all the law and prophets at this point are, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. And they're standing there and they are talking with Jesus. Now, Matthew does not tell us what they were talking about, but Luke does. Luke 9:31 says that they spoke to Jesus about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. What are they talking about? His death and resurrection. Isn't that interesting? That the law and the prophets, the ones that define the nation of Israel, that give them their lens for the kingdom, come to Jesus and they're like, hey, we need to talk about this cross and resurrection thing. I wonder if they had questions, the law and the prophets. Or I wonder if it was just straight encouragement. You can do this, Jesus. Or if they were going, oh, we did not see this coming at all. But that's brilliant. Or maybe Elijah's going, yeah, explain to me how this works again. Because I really thought you guys were, you know, I'm a Malachi 4:5 guy. You know, that I'm supposed to come before the great day of the wrath. And explain to me how this whole cross thing works again. Bottom line is, the conversation that Jesus and his disciples were having at the end of 16 is continuing now with the law and the prophets on Mount Transfiguration. And it will be also what concludes their conversation at the end when they come down the mountain. Okay, let's keep reading. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Now, some people, a lot of people, most commentators that you'll read will say that what Peter was doing here is he just, and he does say this in Mark, he just didn't really know what to say. And so, you know, he just really wanted this moment to last longer, and he thought maybe we'll make some shelters. Everybody will hang out. They'll even emphasize the fact that it is odd that he wants three, because it almost is like he's putting Moses, Elijah, and Jesus all on the same plane. That is a little strange. But I will say this. I don't think Peter's statement is that dumb, because in the intertestamental literature, there was a belief, a conceptual belief, that before the kingdom was established, you would have the appearance of these particular figures, and the tabernacles would be built to help commemorate the emergence of the eschaton. I think what he's doing is he's saying, I'm a good Jewish boy. I know the lens I'm supposed to be looking through, and this is about to happen, isn't it? Let's build the shelters now. I'll build them. I'll do it. You just sit there and talk amongst each other, you know, Old Testament people and Jesus. This is cool. So I don't think he's being an idiot. I don't think he's just going, man, I hope this never ends. I don't think it's him at the end of camp saying, oh, if I could only be at CIY every day. That's not what he's doing. He's saying the eschaton's about to begin. And I want to be the one that's building the tabernacles for you. Because let's launch this attack. Let's go to Jerusalem. Verse 5, while he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, really quick, right now we have an emphasis on cloud, heavy. If you're a Jew, where does your mind go to in the Old Testament? There are three significant moments of clouds enveloping things or playing major roles in things. Yes?
The completion of the tabernacle.
Yes. And the tabernacle is definitely one of them. We get that in Exodus 40. Whenever the cloud descends and envelops the tabernacle, it stands for the presence of the Lord. Absolutely. What are the other two? Say that again?
The escape from Egypt.
Yeah, the escape from Egypt. They are led by day by a cloud. The presence of God guiding his people. One other place. The coming of the clouds, I can see where that would make sense. I was thinking of a different one.
The giving of the law
on Mount Sinai, whenever the entire cloud was enveloped by a cloud. The presence of God. And these all come from the Exodus. You've read this. this semester. These all come from the Exodus. And that's kind of the things that's describing here. The presence of God, a cloud enveloping someone, would mean that there's about to be a theophany. This is my son, the voice says, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. We've heard that before, right? Where is that again? Jesus' baptism in Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 through 17. And he is quoting, this is a combination of two Old Testament texts. What are they? This will be on your test. Psalm chapter 2, verse 7. And Isaiah chapter 42, 6 through 7. Look back on your notes that we talked about on Matthew 3 to get a fuller explanation of those. So he says the exact same thing, except for this time he adds an addendum. He says, listen to him. We have just come off of a section. We've just come off of several chapters in which the voice of Jesus is hard to hear because everybody else's voice is trying to tell him what he's supposed to say. Isn't it? This conflict, victory, conflict, victory. Jesus says, I'm going to have to be betrayed and then I will resurrect. And Peter says, hold on, Jesus, that's not supposed to happen. He's telling Jesus, shut up. And the voice from the cloud says, no, Peter, you shut up. Jesus' voice is the one that's supposed to be heard. But this also is added significance when we read Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. Say it again. Deuteronomy 18, 15. Real important text. Deuteronomy 18, 15. This is Moses speaking, and it is considered a highly messianic text. For Moses says this, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, like Moses, from among your own brothers. And this is how the verse ends. You must listen to him. You see that? Psalm chapter 2, verse 7, Isaiah 42, 6 through 7, and now Deuteronomy 18, 15, all come together to paint this picture that this is the Messiah. And whatever he says, listen to him. Quit trying to force him into your own boxes and allow him to create the box that he's going to dwell in. Listen to him. This is the prophet to come. This is the Messiah, which would be, by extension, the king. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. The most frequent command in all the Bible is don't be afraid. And yet it is always in conjunction of people fearing. Sometimes the wrong things, sometimes the right things. In this context, they were fearing the right things. For the only thing Matthew chapter 10 tells us that is to be feared is the one that can destroy our souls, not our bodies. But whenever that one person, whenever that one entity, whenever that one deity says, don't fear, you're good to go. Fear nothing. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. This is what I think is happening here. What you have is you have the presence of God in the cloud. You have the law and the prophets, all the Old Testament, and you have Jesus. And in the moment when the voice speaks, it drives their face to the ground. It drives them to the ground, terrified, laying as though dead. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. They look up. Everyone's gone but him. And I think symbolically what it is saying is this. I fulfill the law and the prophets. I am the fulfillment of all that you have seen and heard. I am the clear revelation of God on earth. I am all that the law and the prophets were pointing to. I fulfill it all. Because when the day is done, when the dust settles and you look up, the only one standing that needs to be standing is me. And in that perspective, listen to me, follow me. But then what he's about ready to say is something that they don't want to hear and they don't want to follow. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Again, he's pointing back to what he had just talked about at the end of chapter 16, which will become more articulate here in just a moment. The disciples asked him, why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? What is the logic behind this statement? Or this question. It's not a statement, it's a question. Tell me, describe to me what the disciples are thinking here. It's a good question. What is it, though? Is it a good question? Maybe I should back up. I'm assuming something there. Is that a good question?
If Jesus is ushering in a kingdom that's different from what they look like, they're still looking for Elijah and waiting for him to usher it in.
Yeah, they definitely are looking for Elijah to be help to be the harbinger of the kingdom. But what is the logic behind the statement that they just had? Think about what they just experienced. What did they experience? What? They saw who?
Elijah.
Yeah, maybe why he's not staying around? Maybe they also be saying this, hold on. Jesus, if you're the Messiah, but we're just now seeing Elijah, then why do they say that Elijah needs to come first? Because he came not first. You came first. Right? Do you see what he's doing? And notice what they do, though, is they put the onus on the teachers of the law, like the teachers of the law messed it up. How come the teachers of the law say, maybe it's even looking at them as like, well, they're our authority. They have been for quite a few years. And did they get it wrong? Implicit in that, maybe they were even asking the question, did Malachi 4:5 screw it up? Is that scripture wrong? Because Malachi 4:5 says, see, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. And again, they're still describing the coming of the Messiah as the great and dreadful day because the enemies don't think it's a delightful moment. So they're asking the question, how come Elijah's come second and you have come first? If you are the Messiah, shouldn't Elijah have come before you? Yes. Malachi 4:5. So they're asking the question, are the teachers of the law wrong in their interpretation? Is the scriptures wrong? What gives here? And Jesus answers them by saying this. To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. He says, no, teachers of the law weren't wrong. Neither was the scriptures. He says, but I tell you, Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. Who is he pointing to? Huh? Yeah. He's saying, no. It's not that Elijah coming first that they've messed up. What they've messed up is who Elijah is. That's who they've messed up. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what the disciples understand him saying in verse 13. Then the disciples understood that he was talking about John the Baptist. Jesus says, the sequence still holds true. But how you define Elijah is what makes the difference. They're looking for literal Elijah, which we just happened to chat with. But I'm telling you, John the Baptist is the Elijah that was to come before me. Yeah?
I'm confused as why Jesus says Elijah is coming, and then in the next part of the sentence, he says Elijah already came.
But
that's just the New American Standard.
I was going to say, is coming. Well, I mean, you're kind of wrestling with the... You're kind of wrestling with the fact of like the Elijah comes, the concept of that, like that sort of present tense. Could it depends on the context whether or not it is present, past, or future? Because he's referring back to what they said. Isn't he supposed to be the one that comes? What I'm saying is this: whenever you start taking the tenses and you pull them out into a vacuum, then it doesn't make sense. But whenever you keep them in context, it makes perfect sense. Of course, Elijah is supposed to come. Now, am I talking future there? Am I talking past? It depends on my point of view. You see what I mean by that? Language is a little more slippery than just simple past, present, future. It can help us, but it can also confuse us. Because clearly Jesus is talking about, of course Elijah comes first. Of course he comes first. In that, though, that's a present tense, even though it's referring about something in the past. So really, whenever you're coming to tenses, you really also have to add in point of view so you can establish what the actual tense is, the way it's functioning. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but all that to say, Jesus says Elijah comes first and will restore all things. Sounds future. But whenever he gives the actual reference of John the Baptist, it's actual past. So is Jesus confused? No. We're just not allowing language to function the way language functions. And even whenever I just said that, the word functions, am I talking present tense, past tense, or future tense? Yes. even though I use the future or the present tense, it actually functions the same way in all three if I'm looking at each referent. See what I mean? Does that make sense, anybody? Okay. All right. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Jesus points out two different things that they got wrong. Number one, that Elijah was John the Baptist. And number two, that they both were supposed to die. The Son of Man, the King, is going to suffer at their hands. Who's there? Who is the they? What? Teachers of the law. How come the teachers of the law say Elijah's supposed to come first? Boy, the teachers of the law are blowing it all over the place. They didn't understand who Elijah was, and they clearly don't understand who the king is, because they killed both of them. Job well done, friends. Job well done. When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. "Lord, have mercy on my son," he said. "He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him." Jesus gets a little upset here. But my question is, who's he getting upset toward? I wish we could picture. It's kind of like whenever people talk to me sometimes, whenever they'll listen to lectures of mine online, and they'll be like, the problem is I don't know what you're pointing to a lot of the time. Because you'll start talking about something, but I can hear that you're talking something in the class. Like if I was in the setting, I would understand it. But whenever I'm just hearing it, I can't understand what you're talking about. Because sometimes I do a lot of this. You know, like this refers to this. See, the people on here right now, they have no idea what I just did. No clue. And this is kind of one of those moments in Jesus' life where you're sitting here and you're going, unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Is he talking to the guy that came there asking for mercy and compassion? Or is he talking to his disciples? I'll be honest with you, with the way this plays out, I think he's talking to the disciples. You want to know why? Because they couldn't cast the demon out. And you want to know why? Whenever they ask the question, how come we couldn't, what does he say? Verse 20, because you have so little faith. Because you keep redefining who I am and trying to function off of tools and trying to function off of programs that do not fit my kingdom. I think right now he's reflecting on the Jewish leaders. I think he's reflecting on his own disciples because they don't get it. I don't think he's coming at this guy that's saying, help me. And Jesus is going, oh my word, you annoy me. Stop asking for my help. I only have so many miracles I can do. My quota's about up, which is why I'm running to Jerusalem. You know, I don't think that's what he's saying. He says, bring the boy to me. See, I can almost hear a change of voice, of inflection there. How long must I be here with all you people that don't get who I am? And then it's like he turns to the guy and he says, bring your boy to me. Bring your boy to me and let me show you how this kingdom functions. Because the disciples, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Jesus rebuked the demon and it came out of the boy and he was healed from that moment. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, why couldn't we drive it out? That's an important question because Jesus has just said in chapter 16 that on this rock I will build my church and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Which means they should have the power to barge into the kingdom of Satan, knocking down the doors and taking their spoils away, which happens to be people. And yet, right after he says that, they can't. And so, naturally, they ask the question, how come? I thought you were the Messiah. I thought we were sons of the kingdom. And yet, whenever we come to the kingdom of Satan, how come we can't kick Satan out? And Jesus says, because you have so little faith. How is faith defined? I forgot who was saying this. The acknowledgement and submission of the authority of Jesus. Somebody, I forgot who was talking to me about this. But they use this. This is not an original metaphor with me. But they said, you know, a lot of times we look at faith as taking coins and putting them in jars. And if your jar is full enough, then you can cash in. That is a lot of times we look at faith. But that is not faith. That is not faith. Faith is the acknowledgement and the submission of who Jesus is. And as a result of that, what authority does he have? And what does that mean then for who you are and what you are able to do? The disciples think that Jesus is a different Messiah than what he has been still, or what he's claimed to be still. And he says, why couldn't you cast him out? Because if you have a different lens of who I am, then you're fighting for the wrong side. And a kingdom divided will not be able to stand. Do you see how this is all playing together? If you're fighting from the lens of the Satan of King or the kingdom of Satan, guess what? You're not going to be able to cast out demons. Because Satan wouldn't cast out Satan. Doesn't make sense. We've got 3 minutes and counting. Here we go. Because you have so little faith, I tell you the truth, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, where have we heard that? Chapter 13. You can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. Right now, this is going to come back up again later. Jesus is going to use this same concept, this mountain moving with our faith, later. Here, though, here, and that emphasis will be different. Here, the emphasis, though, is on the power of God, the power of God's kingdom, if we trust who He is and what He is establishing. Nothing is outside of the realm of possibility. Even people raising from the dead becomes an absolute possibility if the kingdom of God is real. When they came together in Galilee, He said to them, the Son of Man, the King, is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill Him, and on the third day He will be raised to life. And the disciples were filled with grief. Their response to Jesus' second most clear way of describing the way in which His kingdom wins, their response betrays their lens. They still can't look at that and say, yeah, that's victory. They look at that and they say, oh my word, what is He talking about? Even right after the voice on the Mount Transfiguration says, shut up and listen to Him. He says something, and what do they do? Yeah, wow, what do we even do with that? They go into a depression because He's trying to reveal the way in which the kingdom wins. You see the irony in this? And what chapter 17 does is it brings us up to kind of the present moment. We've summarized everything we've been in. What we've found is that the disciples are still as confused as ever. And the very next section on the temple tax will pick up that same theme, but we'll do that tomorrow morning. I love you guys. Have a good rest of the day. See you in the morning. What?